Let me give you just a little idea of what's going to happen tonight. I'm going to give you a short history of radio and free radio, hopefully very short. After that, Teresa Caraggio, who is a programmer at Free Radio, is going to introduce tonight's speaker. After the talk, there will be a brief intermission, and we will be collecting some funds for a new scholarship fund, which you'll hear more about later on. And following our short intermission, there will be a question and answer period. This all has to end at 9:30, at which point we're going to get you all out of here. But anyway, that's tonight's program. Radio was corralled into working by a very interesting character by the name of Nikola Tesla. And back in 1893, he started doing little tabletop demonstrations of radio broadcasting for college students and interested people. And the following year, in 1894, was the actual first broadcast of radio. This took place at Oxford Museum of Natural History, and the two people involved with that are Professor Lodge and Professor Moorhead. Some of you might say, well, what about Marconi? We've all heard about Marconi. Well, Marconi actually didn't come along for another few years, and of course, being a businessman, he patented radio in 1896. And very shortly thereafter began the age of radio, with stations and equipment being set up. And by the turn of the 20th century, radio was beginning to seep into households and businesses around the world. Some of the first applications, of course, were at sea. And of course, the sinking of the Titanic was probably one of the first instances in which radio was actually used for rescue. The first actual radio program was broadcast in 1906 in Massachusetts. It was a program of Christmas carols broadcast to ships at sea. By 1920, radio was pretty much starting to pervade America, at least, and the first newscast was broadcast in Detroit, Michigan in 1920. Also in that year, the first student radio station went on the air, and that was at Union College of New York. Well, you might say, when did pirate radio start? Well, pirate radio started actually in 1907. The United States Navy, who was broadcasting to ships in sea, began complaining about interference from amateur broadcasters. And so pirate radio was born. And that led, of course, to the Radio Act of 1912, which was the first attempt by the United States government to regulate radio. That worked until 1934, when the Communications Act of 1934 was passed by Congress, and the nasty, nasty Federal Communications Commission was born. The first commercial pirate radio station, you might say commercial pirate radio station, what's that? Well, in Europe, radio was basically run by the governments. Britain had a radio service, France had a radio service, and so commercial broadcasters didn't have any way to get their commercials on the air, and more popular forms of music couldn't get on the air because the BBC would not broadcast rock and roll except for a half an hour program on Sunday afternoons. So the first actual pirate radio station, and the ship for which pirate radio actually got its name, was Radio Mercure, and went on the air in 1958. Probably the most famous pirate radio station was Radio Caroline. And Radio Caroline was actually named after JFK's daughter. And one of the sort of an interesting little Santa Cruz fact involved with Radio Caroline is that one of the original disc jockeys on Radio Caroline, a man by the name of Tom Lodge, actually lives up on Bonnie Doon Ridge. And next year, we are hopefully on our 15th anniversary for Free Radio. I'm going to drag Tom down here, and we're going to have a Beatles radio show with Tom Lodge, who was one of the first people to put the Beatles on commercial pirate radio back in 1960. And where did modern-day pirate radio come from? Well, pretty much pirate radio as we know it today, and the sort of the movement that Free Radio was part of, began in 1979. In 1979, National Public Radio and the National Association of Broadcasters, ever hear those people? They convinced the Federal Communications Commission to eliminate what was then known as Class D radio stations. Class D radio stations were 10-watt student and community radio stations that had sprung up all across the United States. And NPR felt that these stations were competing with them, and the National Association of Broadcasters felt that they were competing with them for listeners. And so the FCC in 1979 closed down all Class D radio stations and forced those stations to either go off the air or get licenses as regular radio stations. The move to sort of overturn that came in the year 2000 when a bunch of people, including Stephen Dunifer and the Prometheus Project, convinced Congress to pass the low power FM, forced the FCC to pass the low power FM rules, which the following year Congress actually tightened up. All right, so that, here we are today. Free Radio Santa Cruz itself started right here in Loudoun Nelson Center back in 1995. I went to some of the first meetings in classroom down the hall here. Group of people sitting around the room going, let's have a radio station. Why? Well, most of the people in the room were associated with groups such as Food Not Bombs, Cop Watch, Earth First, and other community groups which couldn't get on the local NPR radio station. And we had no way to get our voice out. So working with what we had, the people in that room put together Free Radio Santa Cruz, which originally operated from a bedroom and then a garage. Some of the other places that we broadcast from were a kitchen, where they put up a sheet across half the kitchen. A water heater closet was probably our most famous broadcast location. The water heater was over here, and you turned around and the studio was here, and if you wanted to interview somebody, you had to open the door to the closet, and they had to sit outside, as I remember. We also existed in a basement, which would actually be a sort of a glorified way to refer to it. It was actually a crawl space underneath a building over here off of Chestnut. And to get into it, you know these doors you get in the basement where you have to open the doors up like this? And then, anyway, it was underneath. We've operated in attics, and we're currently back in a basement. We're currently an underground radio station again. We've operated on the frequency of 89.3 until KUSP wanted it back. We operated for a number of years on the frequency of 96.3, and we're currently broadcasting at 101.1. We left 96.3 because there was a Christian station came on the air, Air One, over in Monterey, and some of you may notice we lost range about 18 months ago because a Christian station over in the Gilroy area started broadcasting. Some of you also may remember that on September 29th, 2004, armed agents of the federal government appeared at our doorstep and took all of our equipment and made off with it. We were back on the internet within 24 hours, and we were back on the air within 30 days. And most of that was because you, the citizens and supporters of this city, gave a lot of money so that we could go back on the air. Free Radio Santa Cruz is currently a collective of 28 people. We all pay for the privilege of broadcasting to you. We're a diverse group of people, all the way from high school students up to, I just turned 60 this year myself, and I think there's actually some people are slightly older than I am in the station. Yes, Robert over here. We broadcast a wide variety of programming, some of it derived from very well-produced shows on the internet, and then we also have our locally originated programs. We are putting more and more Spanish language programs on the air. We have one of the only Spanish hip-hop shows, as far as I know, in the world. And we started a few weeks ago broadcasting Spanish news at 5:30 in the afternoon. So what can I say? Free Radio Santa Cruz is here for you. Did the survey get passed out? No. We were going to pass out a survey tonight to ask you about what you thought about free radio, but I guess that didn't happen. A lot of things with free radio kind of happen here and there. Finally, I'd like to invite you to listen to my show, which is on Thursday nights at 8 o'clock, From the Cream to the Dregs. I also do the Earth First Update and Environmental News show at 9 o'clock. At this time, I'd like to introduce Teresa Caraggio, who will introduce tonight's speaker. Teresa.
Thank you, Uncle Dennis. My name is Teresa Caraggio, and I have a show, Third Paradigm, which is on Sundays at 2 and Thursdays at 10. The first time that I heard Michael Parenti was in the parking lot of Gold's Gym. He was being interviewed on TUC Radio, which a Free Radio Santa Cruz broadcast. I sat in the car with the battery running, listening to the radio for the rest of the program, wishing I could trade in my iPod for a Walkman so I could keep listening while working out. When it was over, I said, I have to find out more about this guy. And I wrote down TUC Radio's info. The next week, I happened to decide to join Free Radio Santa Cruz. So I went to my first programmer meeting and found out that Michael Parenti was coming to do this fundraiser. With this kind of immediate wish fulfillment, I'm thinking to up the ante to world peace next time I get a clear connection to the cosmic request line. When I did the background, though, I found out that even though my feeling was, where has this person been all my life, he actually has been around all my life and wasn't my private discovery. His doctorate is from Yale. He's taught at numerous universities. He's won awards from Project Censored, the Caucus for a New Political Science, the City of Santa Cruz, New Jersey Peace Action, the Social Science Research Council, the Society for Religion and Higher Education, and other organizations. Some of his writings have been translated into Arabic, Azeri, Bangla, Chinese, Dutch, French, German, Greek, Italian, Japanese, Korean, Persian, Polish, Portuguese, Russian, Serbian, Spanish, Swedish, and Turkish. For several years, he was a visiting fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in D.C. and is now on the advisory boards of Independent Progressive Politics Network, Education Without Borders, and the Yasenovitch Foundation, as well as the advisory editorial boards of New Political Science and Nature, Society, and Thought. For 11 years, he was a judge for Project Censored. Of the 20 books that Michael Parenti has authored, his best known is Democracy of the Few, now in its 8th edition. At the dinner, I spoke to some who came to hear Michael because of his book Black Shirts and Reds, or because of Against Empire. To Kill a Nation, The Terrorism Trap, and Super Patriotism have been favorites of others. I'm in the middle of reading History as Mystery myself, which quotes from Bertolt Brecht's poem, Questions from a Worker Who Reads, as follows. Who built the seven gates of Thebes? The books are filled with names of kings. Was it kings who hauled the craggy loads of stone? And Babylon, so many times destroyed, who raised that city up each time? In which of Lima's houses, glittering with gold, lived those who built it? Along with remembering the people these accomplishments belong to, Michael sets the record straight when history has been changed. my dad kindly keeps me up to date on how the right is thinking by putting my name on all of their email and mailing lists. So one of them, called Imprimis, is the conservative think tank out of Hillsdale College. They recently sent out an article saying that Christianity was largely responsible for inventing the concepts of equality and liberty. Michael's voluminous data begs to differ. Among other things, in his website's archives is an article on Mother Teresa and the Fast Track Saints that you have to read to believe. I'm looking forward also to his upcoming book on God and His Demons. I could go on at length about contrary notions, which I've underlined heavily, but lastly I wanted to mention the one closest to my own heart. The assassination of Julius Caesar is a people's history of ancient Rome in the last century BC. The phrase that kept going through my head as I read it was, "Everything you think you know is wrong." What shocked me in this book wasn't the level of corruption, which we've all come to expect. It was that they didn't expect their leaders to be corrupt. And several of the elite actually lived up to their expectations. There were members of privileged society who found cunning ways to work against their own class interests. Over and over, Roman leaders emerged who showed solidarity with the popular resistance. Again and again, they were cut down, but it didn't stop new ones from sprouting up. As people of the white bread, I think we've been led to believe that our legacy is only one of oppression. But Michael Parenti shows that for every false hero we lose, a score of real heroes take their place. Please join me in welcoming Michael Parenti.
Thank you. I'm going to talk about the prosperity myth. Wasn't that the subject, that the title we gave it? And its relationship to wealth and labor and the like. You know, throughout history, can you hear, is this picking my voice up? There it is. Throughout history, yeah, but if I, otherwise I'm full head and straining it, so I want to get it amplified. Throughout history, wealth and poverty have existed side by side, and they're often treated as if it was an unfortunate juxtaposition. Isn't that a shame? So much wealth here for the few, and then so much poverty for these other people. What a shame, isn't that? But it's more than just an unfortunate juxtaposition. In fact, they always existed so closely because there's a causal link between the two. The way you get a small group of people to be very rich is by getting a lot of other people to work very hard, very long, and consume relatively little themselves and have the rest expropriated by the favored few. That's how you do it. The goal is to get those who toil to create more value than they consume. That surplus value, that wealth, is accumulated by the slave owner, the feudal lord, or the private capitalist investor at different times in history. Let's take the first one, the slave owner. The first 8 or 9 presidents of the United States, 7 of them were slave owners. I think the first 8 were. Well, anyway, number 4 is the one I want to talk about. He was called the father of the American Constitution. His name was James Madison. And James Madison, there are 3 things I think you should know about founding father James Madison. 1, he was a slaveholder. 2, he was quite rich. And 3, there's a relationship between his being a slaveholder and being quite rich. 1 and 2 equals 3, actually. Madison once told a visitor to his estate that he made $257 a year off the labor of every slave he owned. and he spent only $12 or $13 a year to feed and sustain every slave. You see, slavery, contrary to a mythology that developed among some historians years later, slavery was very profitable. I mean, you make very good money on slave labor. Because the slave worked from not dawn to dusk. He worked from the crack of dawn well into the night. After nightfall came, he was back on the plantation mending fences and digging ditches and repairing things and preparing whatever else, taking care of livestock. So it was very profitable. That's why the slaveholders did it. They didn't do it because it was unprofitable. They didn't do it because they wanted to take care of these poor, sweet people with their sweet, soft singing. They did it to make money, to make extract from the slaves, to make money. And you'd go all through the South, and there were all sorts of people who were looking to own a slave. And they didn't want to own a slave because it was just the thing to do, or because they got a certain status out of it, because they wanted to make money off this other person's labor. And that's why they defended their institution with the utmost ferocity. And that's why they saw abolitionism to be nothing more than thievery, a stealing of what was rightfully theirs, their wealth. And I said to you, I said that it cost Madison $12 to $13 to feed and sustain each slave. Now that's a false statement, isn't it? That's the slaveholders' talk. Because Madison didn't feed and sustain the slaves. The slaves fed and sustained Madison, and indeed in the style to which he was accustomed. Now, great wealth creates poverty. That's what I'm saying. The poverty of those slaves who had nothing, not even command over their own lives and personalities in any way, the poverty created this enormous wealth. And as wealth has grown, so has poverty. The number of people in the world living in poverty today is growing at a faster rate than the world's population. So poverty is spreading. While wealth accumulates in record abundance in concentrations that are enormous. I'll say a little more about that in a minute. The accepted ideology of capitalism says that that isn't really so, that you're being zero sum, you know, more for me is less for you. That's very simplistic. By the way, that's my position, that so-called I believe that's exactly true. I mean, there are certain instances where you could say, you know, a boss changes everything into computers and gets rid of all the hand files and such, so he wipes out half his administrative staff, and now the productivity of the other half is three times what the larger workforce was. And being three times larger, and because you need a little more schooling, he might have given you a little more of a raise too. So you do share a little bit in the increase in productivity. Usually that's not true. The statistics don't show that. I'll show you. But I mean, there are examples of that sort of thing. But generally, it is zero sum. We hear this told to us, a rising tide lifts all boats. You've heard that, right? No, today a rising tide lifts all yachts. That's the real phrase, you should say. A rising tide drowns many people. That's what because there are a lot of people who are just barely hanging on or drowning. It is zero sum. The more for the landlords, the less there is for the renters. In New York City, when the landlords, after spending millions of dollars, got rent control rolled back, in an effective way. That changed the lives of all sorts of New Yorkers. I'm originally a New Yorker. You could probably guess just hearing me talk. You got a problem with that? So, but there were people who used to go on vacation. No more vacation, because where's the money going? The money's going to the 25% hike in their rent. So there's more for the landlord and there's less for the tenant. It stands to reason. More for the owners means less for the workers. More for the corporate giveaways means less money for the taxpayers, for human services and all. It actually means more taxes for us, more costs. And conversely, it works the other way too. More for the workers means less for the owners. If I, as an owner, every dollar that I spend on stupid things like wages and health benefits and occupational safety and environmental protection and paid vacations, and every dollar I got to spend on stupid things like that is one less dollar I can put in my pocket. So you bet it's zero sum. And the plutocratic class, the plutocracy, by plutocracy we mean rule by the wealthy few. The plutocrats oppose democracy. That's another claim, that capitalism brings democracy. But you find all throughout history, the plutocrats opposed every democratic reform. Abolition of property qualifications, they opposed it. Extension of the suffrage to newly arrived immigrants, they opposed it. Literacy tests that would limit and rule out people from voting with strict registration requirements and such, they supported that and pushed that and pushed that. Everything, every single thing, collective bargaining so that people could have a chance to make a decent wage, they opposed it. They opposed all of those things. And they did not create prosperity. They opposed prosperity. They opposed the empowerment of ordinary working people, and that meant they opposed I don't want to say enrichment, but what would be the word? The betterment for ordinary working people. And to the extent that life in this country today is bearable, to the extent that it's bearable under this relentless, rapacious plutocracy, it's because of the democratic gains we fought for and won. They never gave us a thing. We had to extract every single thing. People paid with their blood and their lives, people, many of whose names we don't even know, for the eight-hour day, for affordable medical care, public education, secure retirement pensions, decent disability insurance, occupational safety, effective labor unions, environmental protections. One could go on. All of them totally inadequate in this country right now. But to the extent that we have anything, it's been extracted, struggles from the grudging grip of this super rich class. The established ideology that we are taught also says that capitalism creates prosperity, not poverty. As I just said, you know, the rising tide, all the boats and all that. I mean, it takes a certain audacity to claim credit for the very thing that you try to undo and roll back. Look at North America and Western Europe, they would say. The capitalist countries are the prosperous ones. But that is a very selective view of capitalism. First of all, there are a lot of poor people in North America, struggling poor and working poor, people who have jobs and still are poor. My argument is that class wealth creates poverty, as I was just saying, and I'll prove it to you in 10 seconds. As against the lifetime of propaganda and ideology, you've had all that. Now, all those years we've been told that. Now you give me 10 seconds. Here's how it goes. Most of the world is capitalist, and most of the world is poor. Most of the world is getting more capitalist, and with privatizations and free trade and takeovers and such, and most of the world is getting poorer. So capitalism works, you say? Capitalism brings prosperity? It does. It works best, but for whom? It works much better in Indonesia than it does in Denmark. In Denmark, the capitalist has all sorts of restrictions. There are worker protections. There are problems. He's got to watch regulations about environment. There are human services. There are heavy taxes he's got to pay. In Indonesia, he's got none of that. There's none of that. There's no consumer protections. There's no minimum wages. And so if a worker gets mangled, you just toss him aside and put another worker in his place. That's where it works. Your investment in Indonesia is multiplied. For every dollar you invest there, you may get 12, 14 back. Where in Denmark, you may get 2 or 3 back, you see. So that's capitalism for you. It works best in countries like Indonesia, much of Africa, Nigeria, Liberia, Mexico, El Salvador, Haiti, capitalist Philippines, capitalist Thailand, and the like. Those are capitalist countries, and that's where you want to really be. If you were Nike, why do you close your factory in Ohio? Why do you go all the way across the world, that vast Pacific, into Indonesia, as a matter of fact? And you have to outsource all the materials. You got to bring all the materials to Indonesia also. Because in Ohio, you were paying these people $12 an hour, plus benefits, plus this, plus that, plus this restriction, that requirement. In Indonesia, it doesn't matter. You can build it any way you want. There's no occupational safety to worry about. There's no toxicity to worry about. If a worker is poisoned, he's just tossed aside. And you pay them 18 cents an hour. 18 cents! So a pair of your Nike shoes would cost only $7. Even though you got to ship it all the way across the Pacific, it still comes to only $7. That doesn't mean you, the consumer, get a break on it. When they bring it back, they don't sell it to you any cheaper than they would have when it was made in Ohio. You think they went always over there to give you a break? They went always over there to widen their margin of profit and to exploit people and take advantage of a low market, where the profit margins are high, the unions are weak or non-existent. So the third world is not underdeveloped. The third world is overexploited. The suppression of labor, of course, goes on. The suppression of labor that goes on abroad also has a depressing and subverting effect on labor at home, so that by exporting that job from Ohio to Indonesia, you are depressing wages at home, because in effect the Indonesian worker is competing with the American worker. Why don't we work for 18 cents an hour when Indonesians do? Is it because we are so more self-respecting, or is it something else? No. In fact, in America, we did work for 18 cents an hour or less back in 1900. I'll be talking about that in a minute. It's that we're now at a stage of historical struggle where we come to a better standard of living. And that's what it is. The Indonesians were emerging and going to become that, but they had a military coup which was supported by the Pentagon and the CIA, and all the reformers and nationalists and people who were trying to develop that country were murdered and slaughtered in a great slaughter back in 1965. And so they're down now to nothing, a perfect free market system. What American labor is told is, look, you got the whole world now is competing. It's a one big global market, globalization we call it. So you got to tighten your belts and you got to really work harder and faster for less in this increasingly competitive global economy. Now the investors are never told to tighten their belts. U.S. national security state should stop suppressing labor abroad, should improve work and wage conditions abroad, lift them closer to our level, not lower us to theirs. In 1991, I called this whole process of rollback going on here as the third worldization of America. In fact, it's really now the third worldization of everywhere, including Europe. Of course, these kind of pressures and struggles going on in Western Europe, most notably, for instance, in Italy and France and places like that. in England, where the welfare state, much of it has been privatized and given a rough handling. And roll back also in our neighbor to the north in Canada. There's a rough but very real correlation between the condition of labor and the condition of democracy. In countries where labor is strong, such as the Scandinavian countries, for instance, personal rights are strong. Human services are good. In countries like those where unionization is very high in the Scandinavian countries. In countries where unions have been destroyed and stamped out, so have civil liberties and human services, Guatemala, Haiti, El Salvador, etc. So the class struggle is a key component in the struggle for democracy itself. There still remains the time-honored view that America is a land of milk and honey, the promised land, what I call the prosperity myth. In fact, you know, there was an extraordinary abundance of fertile lands on this continent that gave a rough and tough but decent existence to many homesteaders. But as late as 1900, with the frontier well closed, the U.S. was a third world nation, half a century before the term was invented. It was, in 1900, a free market paradise. I want to make that clear because I often hear from people who tell me, "You don't know what you're talking about, Parenti. The thing is, we don't have a free market. The free market has never been tried." It's this idea that there's this really pure, beautiful, pure system that has never been tried. And because if it were tried, then you'd see what a marvelous thing it is. You hear that from anarchists, too, that true anarchism has never been tried. And you hear that from Christians. Real Christianity has never been tried, you know. There's only been two real Christians in the world. That was Jesus Christ and Spinoza, and they were both Jews, you know. You can't... Communism, real communism, has never been tried. Well, all these things can only be tried in one place, in this messy, complicated, imperfect world that we have, impure and imperfect world. The free market was tried. It held sway, and the results were those of the free market. In country after country in the 1990s, Argentina, name the ones that all went free market, IMF, what happened to them? You even had mainstream reporters saying, that system doesn't work. It doesn't work. It's terrible. It leads to such impoverishment and instability and the like. And that's when the free market ideologues come forward and say, that's because that's not really the free market. You see, it's a non-falsifiable position. You always fall back to an imaginary perfection, and you're comparing that to what? A very imperfect reality. And of course, the imaginary perfection always comes off looking better. But in 1900, we did have the kind of country that reactionary Republicans and libertarians like Ron Paul dream about. We did try the free market. We had no government regulations or interference, certainly none that were enforced. The market ruled supreme. We had child labor, children working 12 and 14 hours a day. That was the free labor market. We had widespread poverty and underemployment. No pensions or minimum wage protections. No disability insurance. Contaminated foods, even worse than today. Regressive tax systems, even worse than today. No environmental protections. Typhoid epidemics in cities like Philadelphia, Baltimore, the like. Tuberculosis and other diseases of poverty were widespread. People who lived whole lives and never saw a doctor, other than a quack who might come around or something like that, never saw a dentist. By the way, that's still true today in America. You know, there's no There's no public dental insurance. There's only private dental insurance. So you have millions of people. In America today, one-third of the people over the age of 65 have no teeth. That means that when they got a problem and such, they plant or a crown or this or that, a filling, if it was really unsavable, they just had it yanked. And when one tooth is yanked, then another one, then another. And before you know it, that's what we got. So in a way, you see, we're moving back to that third world status that we were in 1900. That was the free market. No restrictions, no government regulations, no bureaucratic red tape, all through the 1990s. Just talk among yourselves a minute. Let me see. You know when you can't read your own notes, just skip it. Move on quickly. Okay. You'll live full happy lives without that fact. Let's look at some more recent. Let's move from 1900 to 1920. Now, by 1920, there was, in fact, the development of a mass consumption market in America. But there also was still mass poverty. I saw a quote by Congressman Fiorello LaGuardia in New York City talking about the conditions of misery in some of the slum tenements. He said, I couldn't believe what I saw, the conditions of hunger and overcrowding and just a real immiseration. Mass immigrations from the 1870s to 1914 also piled in more layers of humanity into the urban slums. Cheap labor, hard labor. Then came the Great Depression, and things went from bad to worse. Now, the Great Depression, the crash of 1929, just didn't happen, you know. There have been things developing all along. There have been a real lag in consumption. There had been a tendency for inventories to be piling up. There had been depression in rural areas throughout America through the 1920s. Even though the urban areas, it was the jazz age and automobile was coming in and the Ford model and all that sort of thing. In the rural areas, they were already experiencing that depression that was still to come. So you saw that kind of thing happening. I remember the Great Depression. I remember it lurking over the consciousness of my family. They always made references to the Depression. Well, the Depression. And I just knew that it was some disembodied kind of monster that lurked around somewhere in our neighborhood, if not in our house. Then came the New Deal with a series of progressive programs that did help to some degree, public works, national parks, Social Security, collective bargaining, a real increase of many billions of dollars in wages through victories won through collective bargaining and unionization, which actually helped the economy. Because every dollar I had to give to those workers, instead of me putting it in treasury notes or in building my mansion or whatever else, every dollar went and he could spend it on other things, and there was the multiplier effect, and the other people who sold that to him, and they had dollars and they would buy things and so forth. So it did start picking up things. That's what Obama is talking about today with his stimulus package. There would be that, what used to be called the Keynesian multiplier. Not that Keynes invented it. People knew about it before Keynes, but he made a big deal about it. That you get some money out there, you create jobs. Those people, by spending money, create more jobs. Just as the cycle is going the other way right now. You're laying off people. They stop buying less. The other people start selling less. They have to lay off their workers. And you go into a downward spiral. Okay. Now, we all know that the New Deal never really pulled the nation out of the Depression. It didn't spend enough. Roosevelt in 1938 decides to balance the budget, increase taxes. just these contracting things, the last thing that the economy needed there, and plunged us back into a recession. But then came World War II, and the government was ready, and so was corporate America, ready to spend at a level to kill people what it would not do to feed people. It couldn't spend at that level to feed people, but when it came to killing people, they went all out into it and really went gung-ho with the whole thing. Now, World War II helps explain that period from 1946, after the war ended in 45, 1946 to about 1980, which is known as the Great Prosperity. When we always talk about America as being a great prosperous country, that's the period we really mean, 1946 to 1980. What you had happen in World War II was all sorts of people who would have gratefully have lined up for a job for $25 a week or $30 a week, were now, I remember my uncle Nick, he worked in a defense plant. Instead of, he used to be an auto mechanic, made that kind of money, just barely made a living. He went into a defense plant, and with overtime and everything else, he was making $100, $120 a week. You have no idea what in 1942, 43, 44, for working class Italian-American family in New York, what $120 a week was. I mean, that was money. And people were making very good money suddenly. Women who had never even knew they could be employable were suddenly now becoming Rosie the Riveters and getting out there and getting these jobs of all sorts. And so there was a lot of money. And I used to hear from my uncles and my dad all saying, you know, after this war is over, there's going to be a depression again. It'll all come back. The depression will be here. And they anticipated that this war and this spending would just not be enough. Well, what happened when the war ended was that there was an enormous backlog of consumer demand, and there was an enormous backlog of money. That people made more money, but there was nothing to spend it on. Everything was rationed. You couldn't buy a new car. You couldn't buy cars. All the auto factories were making tanks and planes. You couldn't buy a refrigerator. You couldn't buy this or that, the other thing. So there was this sudden backlog. And instead of the crash coming, instead of a depression coming, there was this immense amounts of money suddenly pouring in. Suddenly, Levittown was being built in little ticky-tack houses, and people actually had enough money to put a down payment down on houses. And there was a prosperity that came from the earnings of war among the working class itself, with this backlog of unsatisfied consumer desires. Another factor that led to this prosperity was a remarkable piece of legislation. Its nickname was the GI Bill of Rights, which actually, the imagination in that day was still about World War I. I remember seeing that in newspapers too, cartoons or illustrations, photos of boys who came home from World War I and they ended up selling apples in the street. This became an iconic symbol. Are they going to be selling apples in the street with a little stand, you know, 5 cents apples? This was like, you know, this was the image of how someone is hit bottom. So instead, Congress, of course, in gratitude to all these men and a few women too, all of them going to war for us and saving us from the Axis powers, this GI Bill was passed. And it was really a remarkable piece of legislation because about 9 to 10 million returning veterans went off to school. These were people who had never dreamed of even, some of them of even finishing high school, were now finishing high school, going to college, and getting full-time stipends and getting their tuition paid and pursuing careers, advanced education, expanding the production, productivity, and skills and opportunities of an economy as never before. When you invest, it really is true, when you invest in people and their capacities, it's a good way of investing in your economy too. So billions more were poured into the economy. So that was the second big factor that led to this reality of prosperity. Well, you can say, well, we have a GI Bill of Rights right now. It's that law is still in operation. Why isn't it having such a salutary effect? The GI Bill today is a pale shadow of what it was in 1945, 47, 48, 50. When I was in college, the early 50s, we still had GIs coming back, going on the GI Bill to college. Today, even with the GI Bill, it doesn't pay full stipend. It doesn't pay full tuition. Veterans discover that they go back to school and they've got to get a part-time job, sometimes two jobs. They find they have to still also get student loans. A lot of them get disgusted and give up. And these were often young men and women who went into the Army in the first place in the hope of getting an affordable college education later on. So it doesn't work today. They have ground away and gnawed away at it and have diluted and undermined it, as they've done with so many other New Deal and Square Deal and Fair Deal and all the other gains that were made in the 60s and 70s. A third factor for this prosperity was the war itself, in that it also created, at public cost and at a national debt, a huge reserve of profits and investment funds within the plutocracy. Now, the United States was already the world's leading manufacturing power by 1890. When William McKinley was president, the U.S. was already manufacturing more than any other country in the world. But after World War II, the United States was the only manufacturing base that was still perfectly intact and actually bigger and more vigorous than ever. So it took over more and more markets, even as European production was in shambles at the time. So war, you know, is a form of creative destruction for capitalist reinvestment. A fourth factor for prosperity was the Cold War, because the Cold War, while there was a great dismantling of military spending, you would no longer keep 15 million people in the armed services. They were all deployed and such, but you still had a very big military budget, and you built up a military economy, and with all sorts of suppliers and subsidiaries, whatever else, spending the taxpayers' money and maintaining a certain level of investment and income and profit. So those things taken together gave us this prosperity. And in those years, 46 to, say, 80, working people were working eight-hour days. They had job security and seniority, paid vacations, time and a half overtime, company medical insurance, adequate retirement pensions, and all that. Many of them lived in decent housing and even could pay a mortgage on a home of their own, while their kids went to public school and even to public universities that cost relatively little. So millions of people who never dreamed of it were now living a middle-class lifestyle, had a car and a house they were paying for and all that. And that was the big American dream. And there was a whole literature, a whole Hollywood set of films. Everybody in Hollywood lived in that kind of home. Nobody lived in a crowded tenement anymore and all that. And the rest of the world saw this, and the rest of the world was convinced, as I say, America was the land of milk and honey, where everybody was doing well. I remember when I was in Moscow talking to some of the Moscow intellectuals. This was back when it was the Soviet Union. It was a communist country. And I remember one of the guys saying, the poorest people in your country live better than I do. And here's a guy, he had an apartment, a small apartment, but it was comfortable, it was small, a whole wall full of books. He'd been educated at Moscow University. He spoke fluent English, never missed a meal in his life. And he said, the poorest people in your country live better than I do. And we would say to him, You know, we got people sleeping in doorways and eating out of garbage dumpsters and such. And you know what they'd say? They'd say, that's all right, you don't have to lie to us anymore. We know that's not true. So they knew. They had all the certainty of inexperience. The certainty of inexperience told them that this was the perfect world. And many of us felt the same way. Yeah, there were still millions living in poverty. It's true, but poverty meant something different here than other places, and we did have this wonderful thing. One group that was convinced of this prosperity was the plutocrats themselves. And it was interesting, in 1978, you had a group of, they weren't Bilderberg, and they weren't maybe Knickerbocker Club. I got the quote somewhere, and I thought I had it here, but I don't. People who said, what's going on in this country? More and more concessions, more and more to the working populace. This is going to become a social democracy. I mean, they actually use that term. We are developing into a social democracy. We've got to stop this sort of thing. And by social democracy, they meant a Denmark or a Sweden or a Finland or a Norway, something like that. And so they actually called for a rollback. And the pressure was put on the President of the United States in 1978. That's when the word came out. And the pressure was put right on that president. And that president was a Democrat by the name of Jimmy Carter. And that year, his budget came out and it showed cuts in human services, increase in military spending, and wanting to transform or diminish the taxes, more regressive taxes for the rich. Paul Volcker, chair of the Federal Reserve in 1980, quote, the standard of living of the average American has to decline. It was just getting too much. The plutocracy doesn't want to face a self-confident, well-educated populace that has a high sense of entitlement. That's not the kind of, they want a population that's hungry, that's desperate. The more hungry you are, the more desperate you are, the harder you will work for less and less. That's how we can get America back to being 1900, get it back to being Indonesia. Now notice what Volcker said. The standard of living of the average American has to decline, not his standard of living. He's not an average American. And he didn't miss one filet mignon dinner from all this cutbacks at all. And decline it has, starting really in earnest with the advent of the Reagan administration in 1981. There was an increase in poverty and homelessness, substandard housing and schools, increase in that, longer work days with no overtime pay, time and a half. Now we have time and a half for no pay. People are forced to work extra hours and not get paid anything more for it. A growing tax burden increasingly shifted onto the backs of lower income strata. Fewer, if any, vacation days, inadequate health care, millions more without affordable health insurance or with health insurance that doesn't really insure, privatization of public services, and one could go on, cutting disability assistance, cutting family support, undermining environmental protections and the like. And yet all we ever heard was that the economy was sound, that it was doing well. As of the spring of 2004, this past spring, just a few months ago, you had George Bush giving talks about how our economy is basically sound. The joker word there is basically there. If you happen to be in the unbasic parts of it, you're really getting it hit. I remember hearing an NPR station that said, NPR news analyst, he said, if you remove food, fuel, and housing from the equation, inflation hasn't been all that bad. Isn't that great? That's an interesting, if you remove a few more things, it disappears altogether, inflation, doesn't it? But that's an interesting mode of analysis, isn't it, that to do that? I mean, can you apply that to a lot of other things? You say, if you don't count the last 15 years, none of us has aged all that much, right? It's marvelous. It's a real feel-good way of looking at things, I would say. In 2007, four American workers were producing what it had taken five of them to produce in 2006. So in other words, productivity had advanced by 20%. But wages didn't advance by 20% or even 5% or 10%. Wages were held flat. By 2005, the hourly wages of average workers was 11% lower than they had been in 1973, adjusted for inflation. Despite this rise in worker productivity, corporate executives, by contrast, the average increase in their income was 30% in 2004 alone, in 1 year alone, 30% increase in a survey done of the 2,000 largest companies. Medium household income has fallen unprecedented 5 years in a row. It's actually, that was 2001 to 2005. These are old statistics. It's really more like 7 or 8 years in a row now. It'd be even a lot lower if you didn't count households. But you see, what often happens in a household is 10 years ago, one person was working, now two or maybe three. The son or daughter doesn't leave and stays at home to be able to live at an affordable rent or rent-free or whatever, and also works. Holly Sklar, she said this, we are breaking records. She said this in January 2006. We're breaking records we don't want to break. Record numbers of Americans have no health insurance. The share of national income going to wages and salaries is the lowest since 1929. Did you get that? Of the gross national income, the share that goes to wages and salaries, lowest since 29. The rest of it is going off to bonuses, fees, profits, and the like. A Republican Congress in 2005 voted the biggest cut in history to the student loan program at a time when college was more expensive than ever. Public college tuitions have risen even faster than private tuition, about 55% in one decade, which is a form of privatization of public education. You keep it as a public institution, you just keep charging tuitions and the like. Well, you get the picture. The infrastructure built by earlier generations has eroded greatly, undermining the economy as well as public health and safety. Now, these are all data from well before. I mean, these notes, too, are from well before the crises of this October and such. But many of us were saying this. Many of us were saying, we disagree with President Bush. The economy isn't in such good hands. It's not going well. Now, there's another function. There's a function of government that's often not mentioned. And it consists of preventing the capitalist system from devouring itself. That is, the function of the capitalist state, the function of the state is to protect property from those who have not property. That's what Marx wasn't the first to say that. Adam Smith said that. John Locke said that. Thomas Hobbes said that. James Madison said that. I can give you the quotes. I got them in my various writings. They say again and again, it's the function of the state is to protect those who have property from those who don't have it. But I argue there's another function. The function of the capitalist state is to protect capitalism from the capitalists. As Marx said, he said, one capitalist will kill many capitalists. In other words, he was saying, there's a war here that goes on, really. One of the problems in the capitalist system is that it has a tendency to self-destruct. Marx gave that core contradiction, which is the tendency toward overproduction and market crises. An economy that's dedicated to making workers produce more and more for less and less is always in danger of a crash. If you want to maximize profits, you want to suppress wages, because wages cut into profits. That's what you want to do. So wages have to be kept down. But someone has to buy the goods and services being produced. And for that, wages must be kept up. And so there's a chronic tendency, and we're seeing that today, toward overproduction of private sector goods and services and underconsumption of necessities by the working populace. In addition, there's also the destruction that comes from the money players themselves. Many of them, instead of worrying about producing goods and services, will just tap into money streams or will pilfer their own companies. We saw the most dramatic case of that just a few years ago, right, with Ken Lay and Enron, right, banks. I mean, Enron was a viable, healthy corporation. Well, after Ken Lay was finished with it, having stolen or mousetrap play in football is called. You just sucker in all the people in you, and then you whack them with it. He brings the price of the value of this stock up high, sells it high, prohibits all the workers, requires them to buy stock with each payment, prohibits them from selling, and then they're stuck with stock that proves to be totally inflated and totally almost worthless. So you had about 5,000 people lost their jobs at Enron and lost their life savings because of Ken Lay. So this is a plunderer. This was, and Andrew Fastow and the whole bunch of others from Adelphi and Harkin and WorldCom and about a dozen other companies, these inside players. Well, most of these thieves were caught and convicted. Doesn't this show that capitalism is a self-correcting system? Well, no, not really, because the prosecution was a product of democracy's accountability and transparency, not capitalism. The push to get at those guys came from the democracy, not from the plutocracy. There's nobody, there was nobody up in the plutocracy who was demanding that Ken Lay be thrown in jail. Name one Fortune 500 CEO who came out and said, this is a disgrace, this is terrible, he should be shot or he should be jailed or whatever else. They didn't say anything like that. Capitalism is an amoral system. It has no goods or bads. It has no morality. It has only one stricture, only one rule, caveat emptor, the buyer beware. You take your chances and that's that. Now, in the meltdown we've had in the last few months of the economy, what you've had are these mounting financial surpluses that created a problem for the money class. There were not enough opportunities to invest. But there were not enough opportunities to invest because there were not enough people to buy. It was not just a crisis in investment, it was a crisis in wages. And that's what we're seeing today. In other words, you want to say, are these evils systemic or are they due to vicious perpetrators and personalities like Ken Lay and Bernard Madoff? I would say these two things are not mutually exclusive. That is, the system brings forth and brings to the fore such perpetrators and greatly rewards them. Capitalism breeds the venal perpetrator and rewards the most unscrupulous among them. So the crimes and the crises that we're facing are not irrational departures from a rational system, but the converse. They're the rational outcomes of a basically irrational and amoral system. And worse still, the multi-trillion dollar bailouts that are happening are themselves being turned into an opportunity for pillage. Not only does the state fail to regulate, it itself becomes a source of plunder, pulling out these vast sums that we're all going to have to pay for later on, and leaving the taxpayers to bleed. And I wish people would stop saying our children and grandchildren. And this is going to affect our children and grandchildren. I wish they would stop saying that. I know it's a heart-tugging expression. When you stop saying our grandchildren, and if we don't, the environment, our grand, what do you mean your grandchildren? You're talking to 20-year-olds. They won't have grandchildren for maybe 40 years from now. It's happening right now. It's the things of, we're paying and bleeding right now. The thing is falling apart right now. Please, the state of California may be absolutely broken another month. We're facing these kinds of crises. So promise me you'll stop saying our children and grandchildren, or stop also saying, and by the end of this century, there's going to be a terrible crisis in the environment. What do you mean the end of the century? Everybody will be dead by the end. It's only 2008, you realize that. 92 years from now, almost everybody in this room will be dead. Some of you may be 112 or something, whatever you will be. Okay. So the people who are now, who have always been scolding us for running to the government for a handout, are themselves running to the government for a bailout, more than a handout. Estimated $2 trillion the Federal Reserve, aside from the TARP money that the Federal Reserve has been giving out. Most of the money, the hundreds of billions, gone to the banks. The banks have refused to say what they're doing with the money. This is what New York Mellon, Bank of New York Mellon, quote, "We're choosing not to disclose that," when they were asked, "How are you spending all this money? Where's it going?" This is Morgan Chase, J.P. Morgan Chase. "We have not disclosed that to the public. We're declining to." I mean, the arrogant, overweening, you know, I have a friend, Manny Gonzalez. He says, I have two solutions for this present crisis. One has to do with a lot of spending and stimulus packages and subsidies and such. And the second plan has to do with guillotines, which I think is a great idea. I'm for the guillotines myself. Well, let me stop here and let me just say that I want to make one conclusion, ideological one, that the conservative ideologues convince the public that government just doesn't work. And yet they always expect the government to pull us out of the jams that they create, you see. I want to point out that government does work. Consider something like occupational safety. Every year, about 23,000 people are killed on the job. That's a terrible amount. But you know, back in 1940, every year, 45,000 people were killed on the job. And that was with a workforce that was about half the size of today's workforce. It's true there were more industrial jobs too. But the point is, as inadequate as OSHA is, it has cut down. You don't see the things that government accomplishes in many cases, because what government does is it avoids certain things. I mean, if you have good traffic lanes and good lights and such, you don't see the accidents that don't take place there, you see. And so it is with these other things. Social Security works. It's inadequate. Nobody can really live completely on just Social Security. But it's the most effective anti-poverty program in U.S. history. And a check, and everybody gets their check every month. Medicare works; it has problems and such, and it's been sabotaged in the eight Bush years we've had here. Veterans Administration works; it has had problems too. But all these three programs, they have low administrative costs. They're comprehensive. They've been beneficial to millions of people. They're affordable. They work better. They don't cost that much really for what they're doing. But there's no profits to the private sector. There's nobody in the plutocracy who's making money off them. And that's why they are constantly under siege. Thank you. Thank you.